Maureen Quinn, a senior advisor at the International Peace Institute, very pleased today to have the opportunity to interview Richard Kaplan for the Global Observatory. He's the editor of the recently published book, Exit Strategies and State Building. So Richard, thank you very much. Welcome to the Global Observatory. I have two different questions that relate to regional dynamics as discussed in Exit Strategies and State Building. The first question relates to the influence of regional dynamics on exit strategies from colonial administrations. And my impression from the book is that when exits occurred at the end of colonial administrations, regional dynamics, regional actors were nefarious. Are there lessons you would or could extrapolate from the end of the colonial era on the role of regional dynamics in state building today? What lessons can you draw from those experiences for policymakers and UN missions today?
I should first say that we included discussion of colonial administrations because allusions are often made to the colonial era and analogies to today's international agents as neo-colonial interveners. And so we thought this is often invoked but never really examined, so we included that in the book. I think it's fair to say that then, as now, regional actors had and have an interest in other states in the region, whether these were states emerging from colonial administration or more recently emerging from conflict and international peace and state building efforts. And this is only natural. That interest can take various forms, sometimes more, sometimes less helpful to the state in question. But the regional dimension, and I think this is the lesson for the present, the regional dimension is a very important one in building peace. What's important is to bring regional actors into the equation to support peace, as I think was done successfully in the past with respect to Bosnia and Herzegovina, and also with Cambodia.
The second question on regional dynamics is from the case of Haiti. The author, Johanna Mendelssohn-Forman, suggests a hybrid regional model as a new approach to state building. What do you think of her suggestion to use regional administrative hybrids to provide security that allows for development to advance, but also potentially represents a willingness to be in it for the long haul, something that the United Nations cannot afford and was not designed to do?
Again, there's a very general lesson here, which is that regional and sub-regional organizations can play a very useful role in post-conflict state building. To give an example, the European Union's been doing this very usefully in the Western Balkans, notably in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, and Macedonia, where it's taken on much of the responsibility that the UN and NATO, another regional organization, had exercised. But the EU is a special case. The question is how many other regional organizations are willing or able to undertake such extensive commitments. It is an open question, really, whether any regional organization would be willing to be there for the long haul. What makes the EU experience unique is that it's involving itself in countries that it sees as potential members of the European Union, so it assumes a special responsibility towards those countries.
In William Dirch's chapter on exit and peace support operations, he talks about three different texts by others that define goals or priorities in post-conflict governance. He mentioned Jim Dobbin's book, The Beginner's Guide to State Building, Michael Doyle and Nicholas Sambanis' seven-step program, and Graham Day's policekeeping model. Now, for practitioners in the field who sometimes just happen to be in place when conflict unfolds or a major political change throws out the old state structures, these types of guides can provide a reassuring framework, markers to guide you through fast-changing events. What are your thoughts on these guides?
I actually don't know how reassuring a framework these guides actually are, because what they do is to identify the tasks and sometimes the recommended sequencing of tasks that post-conflict governance entails. But these tasks are numerous and often very difficult to execute well. I mean, it's one thing to identify, as for instance Dobbins does, governance, economic stabilization, and democratization as priorities for post-conflict state building. It's quite another thing to work out which specific measures are to be taken and how in a particular context. If you look, for instance, at Afghanistan, you can see just how challenging the pursuit of these priorities have been there.
William Dirch also talks about exit as a process rather than an event. And then in your conclusion, you too conclude that a key message of the book is that exit is a process, not an event. What key lessons, for example, would you recommend policymakers and military planners take into account in the context of the exit of Western forces from Afghanistan?
Well, I think there are a number of lessons here, two at least, come to mind in relation to exit as a process. I mean, one is that exits are, to a large extent, path-dependent. Exits cannot, for instance, compensate for easily or at all the weaknesses or deficiencies of the state-building strategy, the strategy and the way it's been executed. They inherit what has come before, and they're very much conditioned by what has come before. And so, for instance, in the case of Afghanistan, there was decision taken to work with regional strongmen in the provinces to assist ISAF, the United States military, to pursue a counterinsurgency campaign there. And arguably that has militated against some of the governance goals of building effective and legitimate institutions, government institutions in the center. So in that sense, decisions that were taken earlier have had implications for the exit. And in another sense, I think it's useful to think of exit as a process because exit shouldn't mark the end of all international involvement in post-conflict recovery. It's important to take steps beyond drawdown and exit, formal drawdown and exit, to either consolidate the gains, if there have been gains in state building, or to take measures to mitigate adverse effects if the objectives of the mandate haven't been met. And I think that's something that we are learning. We see evidence of that in peacekeeping and peacebuilding operations. A number of UN-led peacebuilding operations, for instance, have had successor missions that have been less ambitious in many respects, but whose purpose or whose effect often has been to consolidate the peace in the aftermath of a withdrawal. So I'm thinking, for instance, of the successor mission to UNAMSIL in Sierra Leone and the successor missions to UNTAIT in East Timor, even if there was a re-eruption of violence in Timor in 2006. I think the continued attention on Timor helped to facilitate a redeployment of forces to the country when violence did re-erupt, and to maintain international attention on the country to the benefit of the Timorese.
Finally, Ben Crampton's study of the international administration in Kosovo, UNMIK, suggests that UNMIK had very limited influence on the timing of its exit because of the wider great power politics at play in determining Kosovo's future status. Given that exits and state buildings are always political process, is planning for an exit realistic? Do you know examples where a deliberate exit strategy succeeded?
I think Kosovo is an unusual case because the operation's ultimate objective, independence or autonomy within Serbia, couldn't be known because it required agreement among the permanent five members of the Security Council, which was never forthcoming. And that hampered the UN throughout in its efforts to devise an exit strategy because it just didn't know what outcome ultimately it was working towards. Now, it's true that exits and state building generally are fundamentally political in nature, which is to say that very often decisions that are taken with respect to the timing and nature of drawdown and exit are taken because of political decisions, either pressure within the country for a more accelerated transfer of authority, or pressure, for instance, from troop contributing countries to redeploy their assets. But that doesn't mean that planning of any kind is unrealistic. And that's one of the basic premises of this book, which is to argue that while contingency is certainly a factor in all aspects of state building, including exit, there is scope for more informed planning. And we see evidence of that in many of the cases that we examine. There's also evidence of insufficient planning in these cases as well. But you asked about successful exits. Well, I think, again, Sierra Leone is such a case where the drawdown of troops was governed in part by very serious consideration of benchmarks that the Security Council adopted, and as a consequence of that experience has required benchmarking for a number of other peace operations. And I think also the earlier closure of the UN mission in Bosnia and Herzegovina, UNMIB, is an example in some respects of successful exit, with the adoption of its mandate implementation plan, because this comprised specific goals, projects, benchmarks, and timetables. So we do have examples of successful exit from which we can draw, I think, some very useful lessons.
Thank you, Richard, for being here with us today for the interview on the Global Observatory.